The companion who was Maymun ibn Mihran said to him, O son of prophets, have you forgotten that you are in state of i'tikaf and you must not go out of the mosque? Imam alayhi salam replied, No, I have not forgotten. However, I have heard from my father that the Holy Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa sallam used to say, One who strives to fulfill a desire of his Muslim brother is like one who has spent 9,000 years fasting during the days and worshipping during the nights. This story shows the priority of helping others to performing prayer and worship even in the days of i'tikaf. Imam al-Hasan alayhi salam, in fact, wanted to tell that fulfilling the need of a person and helping him or her pleases Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala more than even some of the most rewarding actions. Okay, now let's go for a short break and we will be back in no time.
Lantern.
Under the light of lantern, we'll look at the story, which indicates a moral aspects of our life.
Welcome back, dear audience. You are listening to Lantern from My Arab English Radio, and we are talking about supporting others in our religion. Well, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala says in the Holy Book of Quran, أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم من ذا الذي يقرض الله قرضا حسنا فيضاعفه له وله أجر كريم Whoever gives a virtuous loan to God will receive double from him in addition to an honorable reward. Surah Al-Hadid, verse number 11. God is promising us that if we give in His cause, it will be as if we are giving a loan to Him and He will return it to us multiplied. We should take advantage of this generous offer that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala is setting forth us and give in charity to help others around us who may be in need. Definitely traditions on this subject are numerous and widespread. Helping the oppressed is wajib. This does not mean that it is wajib only to help the oppressed believers. The commands of helping the oppressed in the light of Quran and traditions are only conditional as far as the capability of helper is concerned. Even if the oppressed people are not Shias and they belong to other sects of Muslims, it is still wajib to help them. Even if a non-offensive infidel is being oppressed, the command of enjoining good and forbidding evil dictates that he should be helped and the evil must be eradicated. Okay, dear listeners, it seems that our time for this episode of Lantern has come to its end. I really hope that you have enjoyed this episode, and until another episode, I bid you farewell and may Allah protect you all. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
ألا بذكر الله تطمئن القلوب
To avert famine, there must be road access to Gaza's north. Words from the World Food Programme. After apartheid Israel turns back a convoy trying to get food into Gaza. Hello everyone and welcome back to Gaza Under Attack. I'm Saeed Bourza. U.S.-Israeli bombs continue to rain down on Palestinians in Gaza as talks for a ceasefire grind on in Cairo, Egypt. Hamas has presented its proposal for a ceasefire agreement to mediators. The Israeli regime has not sent any negotiators to the talks. What will their response be? Lebanon's Hezbollah has launched heavy rocket barrages at an Israeli kibbutzim in the north of the 1948 occupied territories in response to an air raid that killed three civilians in southern Lebanon. The Association of Southeast Asian Nations, ASEAN, have called for an immediate and durable humanitarian ceasefire in the besieged territory as the holy month of Ramadan approaches. And apartheid Israel's war cabinet minister Benny Gantz in London after spending 2 days meeting power brokers in Washington. Is this the beginning of the end for Benjamin Netanyahu? In only 5 months, the U.S. Europe-backed Israeli genocidal campaign in Gaza has killed more than 30,000 Palestinians and wounded over 72,000 others. With us on this edition of the program, British-Palestinian student and activist Tarek Othman, and Rick Sterling, a veteran journalist working with the L.A. Progressive, Anti-War, and Al Mayadeen, to name just a few. Rick joins us via Skype from the Bay Area in California, USA. Thank you both for being here. I'll start with you, Rick. Biden gave the impression a ceasefire was as good as done and dusted, yet here we are. What do you think are the stumbling blocks to a cessation of violence at the moment?
Well, the main stumbling block is the United States' refusal to demand that Israel stop its genocide. There have been three United Nations Security Council resolutions that the United States alone has vetoed. The latest manipulation and trick is for the U.S. to say that Hamas is responsible, but in truth, it's the U.S. and the Israeli government.
And what do you make of the U.S. government's claim of putting pressure on Israel to agree to a truce, albeit temporary, and a captive swap?
Well, I think they definitely want a fig leaf, and Joe Biden and Joe Biden's team realize they're in big trouble because the majority of the population in the U.S. and even more so in the Democratic Party are supporting a ceasefire. So they're out on a limb, but they're so beholden to Zionist forces in the United States that they have to do this dance where they pretend to be calling and pushing for a ceasefire and abhorring the slaughter going on there. But at the same time, they want to give Israel more time to try to achieve their goal, which is not achievable.
Exactly. And of course, they continue to veto UN Security Council resolutions calling for an immediate ceasefire, not to mention the continuing flow of American weapons and money to Israel. Tarek, let me come to you for the next one. How does all of this make you feel that, you know, more than 5 months on, 152 days on, more than 30,000 people killed, more than 72,000 people wounded, and yet not an immediate permanent ceasefire?
I don't know, you know, what words there are left to describe the situation in Gaza right now and the situation in Palestine. Every combination of condemnation and visual imagery and visual description has been used. Every poet has used every last, you know, description they can think of. And I'm not going to better describe that. We, as all Palestinians, as all, you know, people who are seeing it, you know, see a genocide unfold with our own eyes, on camera, on Instagram, on social media, whilst our political class are 100% backing it, we've completely been lost for words. There's nothing that can describe it better than
what kind of action will you take? Because we're in an election year, not just here in the UK, but in the States and more than 50 other countries. When you see this dithering on the part of the political class here, as you put it, be it the conservatives or Labour, someone as young as you and the likes of you out there, how will you get back at these people, in power who can stop a genocide but won't or haven't so far?
Well, very simply, I would refuse to vote for any of these supposed representative parties. You know, many people make the comment that if I was to not vote for Keir Starmer or Labour, that would make a Conservative leadership more likely. Mm-hmm. The very simple fact is that if we're going to profess to be in a democracy, then I have every right to have a party that represents me. If we are in a professed democracy, why am I being forced in practically to vote for people who we all know don't represent me and have no intention of representing me and the vast majority of the British public, which, as I'm sure you understand, 67%, I believe.
66%
support an immediate ceasefire. And yet, like you were saying, there's a complete, you know, undemocratic and extremist attitude towards this mm-hmm. that has justified, as we speak, the genocide of my people. And I'm not going to, you know, vote or put my support behind anyone yeah. that hasn't done everything in their power possible to stop that.
And the rise in the number of independent candidates and mm-hmm. minor parties is probably going to put an end to that political duopoly in Westminster.
Well, I hope so.
That is the hope. Rick, we've passed 150 days, as I mentioned earlier, of this relentless bombardment. What is your assessment of where things stand?
Well, in 1967, the U.S. launched a surprise attack on its Arab neighbors, and in 6 days, they were able to decimate the air forces of those neighbors and win that war. In contrast, we've got 150 days or five full months of Israeli slaughter, massacre, and killing, and they are nowhere near achieving their goals. The Palestinian resistance has withstood this onslaught, this slaughter, and I think the Israeli government is desperate because they can see that their goal of winning a quick victory is not being achieved. They can see that the world is increasingly turning against them, even the West, so that the U.S. is you know, almost alone. They're not entirely alone. Germany and the U.K. and France are still supporting them, but less and less so. So the pressure is building, and Netanyahu is desperate, and in a way the U.S. is desperate to see this come to an end.
It sure is desperate. There's, of course, divisions inside the Israeli so-called war cabinet. We'll talk about that in a little later in the program. But meantime, the U.S., Qatar, and Egypt have been attempting to hammer out a ceasefire agreement, at least on the look of it, for a number of weeks with seemingly little progress, despite early optimism. Earlier this week, the Egyptian Foreign Minister Sameh Shoukry met his Dutch counterpart for talks where the fate of the negotiations was outlined.
The negotiations are sensitive. I can't say there is optimism or pessimism, but we haven't reached yet a point at which we can achieve a ceasefire. But it is important that everyone understands the importance of achieving this and to take responsibility for the decisions to be taken in this regard. There must be a clear political will that goes along with this. And some countries have abilities, like the United States of America. And there is a development there in the remarks that were said by the American Vice President last night when she spoke about the importance of an immediate ceasefire.
Rick, let me come to you for this one as well. The Israelis have not bothered to send any negotiators to these talks going on in Cairo. Does this tell you just how little regard they have for the whole process?
Well, it's an indicator, and it's going to be interesting to see what they report back to the International Court of Justice, because they're coming up on the deadline where they have to report. Meanwhile, their overlords in Washington are in deep trouble. Just as in British politics, we're seeing upheavals with George Galloway winning a landslide victory. 7 days ago, we had a Democratic Party primary race in Michigan, which is a very key state in the United States election process, and over 100,000. Registered Democrats voted uncommitted. So this is a sign. Ideologically, Biden is a Zionist. He's dependent on Zionist funds, and yet most of the party is not feeling that way and is increasingly wondering what the heck is going on. So it's the same thing as your guest from Britain was saying, where there's, you know, increasingly a contradiction between democracy and what we're seeing in reality.
Do those electoral developments in the States perhaps explain the Biden administration's eagerness to claim victory in some kind of a temporary truce?
I think they would be very happy to have that happen, but it's a bit of a smokescreen because they're talking about, just like you say, a temporary truce, and whereas other people are saying that we need to have a ceasefire that stops it once and for all.
Correct. And Tariq, Egypt, one of the parties to these ongoing negotiations, could they do more, and could the Arab bloc overall do more to bring an end to this?
I think there's a lot they can do to alleviate the suffering that Gazans are going through at the moment. The borders are still not as open as they should be. There's still not enough aid getting through. And I don't want to say that's the fault of Egypt in so much as it's the fault of the Egyptian leadership, which is an important distinction to make. Mm-hmm. I think we can all agree that Egyptian leadership, just as much of the Arab leadership, is not at all representative of the population and the people in these countries. What we are definitely seeing is a very lackluster response. I think all of us Arab Palestinians are utterly disappointed in what has been, you know, little more than words and messages, and a couple nothing more than sort of virtual signalling, sort of technical achievements of airdropping some limited amounts of aid.
Yeah.
When we're talking about the mass starvation of 2 million people right at their border. So of course there's more they can do. So more they could have done over the past, not just since 7th of October, but for the past 50 years or so, that they've sat idly, or well, maybe not completely idly, but for the current regime has sat idly by as they've seen their brothers across the border under siege for decades now. And I can't say I'm surprised, but I'm definitely disappointed.
And yet some of them normalized ties apartheid Israel,
Egypt,
too, didn't they?
Jordan have normalized ties with Israel.
UAE, yeah.
Yeah, and they've used that, of course, as an excuse.
All right, let me cross over to California again. Rick, we'll highlight in a little more detail the position of Washington in these talks later in the program once again, but highlight for me the impact that is having on the presidential race again, especially for Joe Biden's campaign and the likelihood, so it seems, of Donald Trump going head-to-head with Joe Biden and what that would mean for the Palestinians.
Well, unfortunately, the Palestinians are between a rock and a hard place there, because Donald Trump, while he's very different than Joe Biden on Ukraine and Russia, he, of course, is horrible on the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, and he's as beholden as Biden is to Zionist pro-Israel forces in the United States. So we're looking at a pretty grim picture there. Really the hope has to be in the United States that we can see third parties and alternative parties, such as George Galloway's tremendous victory the other day, appearing and offering an alternative, because right now, for many, many decades in the United States, there's been no difference in foreign policy between the Republicans and the Democrats. Yeah. They may differ and be at odds and at war on domestic issues, but when it comes to foreign policy, it's one foreign policy, and one of that's not pretty, and that's a domination and supporting in the Middle East, supporting Israel. And so that's our reality. Things are, and, I think, it's approaching a breakup point, though.
Yeah, and that's what they say about the big political, the mainstream political parties here, too, the conservatives and labor, that they are not different in terms of their approach to the Middle East and to the Israel-Palestine issue. But let me take a moment to let our viewers know, if they have just joined us, that this is Gaza Under Attack, a deep dive into the news surrounding the ongoing U.S.-led Israeli genocidal war on Gaza, the blockaded coastal enclave. You mentioned George Galloway, Rick, the pro-Palestinian politician. George Galloway has caused a panic in British politics with his landslide win in the by-elections held in Rochdale, Greater Manchester, which accorded him a mandate to speak about Gaza in the House of Commons of the British Parliament. Galloway told us it's time small parties challenged big ones.
A genocide is not a small thing, and the International Court of Justice has already sent Israel for trial, having concluded that there was a plausible case for genocide being committed in the Gaza Strip. That's not a small thing. That doesn't happen every day. But the local politicians here in the council and the national politicians across the consensus of the front benches want to pretend that it isn't happening, want to disguise that they are deeply involved in it. They're giving cover to it and even given military collaboration with it. So, you know, I always put it to the journalists who implicitly criticize me for raising this genocide. If this by-election was taking place in 1940, when Hitler was building death camps for the Jews, would anyone have criticized me for highlighting it in a by-election campaign? Of course, the truthful answer is many of them still would have, because much of the British media was highly supportive of the rise of Hitler and Mussolini. It must spark a rethink, even if not publicly acknowledged, that the people are not with the government. They're not with the opposition. So what does that mean? It means we need a new opposition. It means we need a new government. And that's where we come in. We are offering a program, and the independents that we will ally with are offering a different approach. And suddenly it will become possible for real, meaningful political change. You know, big parties can become small. Look at PASOK in Greece, for example, or the so-called French Socialist Party of Mitterrand and Hollande. They are minuscule now. Big parties can become small, and small parties can become big.
The United States are the chief architect of the bombardment of Gaza, yet have a pivotal role in the negotiations. Here are some words of the U.S. State Department spokesperson on the Biden administration's approach to the talks and why Washington remains optimistic. A deal can still be done.
Israel has to be careful that in achieving a tactical victory, it doesn't endure a strategic defeat. And it remains our advice to them not to do that. In our view, the obstacles are not surmountable. In our view, should be possible to reach an agreement. We think the proposal that Israel put on the table in consultation with the United States and with Qatar and Egypt is one that Hamas should agree to. And it's one that would alleviate the suffering of the Palestinian people and bring about an immediate ceasefire for 6 weeks. And so we think that agreement can be reached.
We have a few more minutes to go. Let's continue the conversation with Tariq Othman and Rick Sterling. And Tariq, let's take each of those sound bites one at a time. George Galloway winning the by-election in Rochdale. You alluded to it earlier on, but could this be a message nationally to a bigger audience out there, bigger number of voters out there, comes the general election, this win, stumping victory by George Galloway?
Definitely, and the message is very clear. The message is very clear for everyone to see that the traditional parties no longer represent us as British people. Not just, by the way, on the issue of Gaza, but we've seen the complete, indifference of both parties to all sorts of issues of poverty and economy here in the UK. And we've seen that the people in this country are simply fed up. And part of that, of course, is we're seeing George Galloway win. But what's also very crucial is that second place was neither Labour nor Conservatives. I believe it was David Tully, an independent candidate.
Mm-hmm.
So what we're seeing is a complete, you know, the demise of the traditional party structure here in the UK, specifically in Rochdale. But what it could be is a sort of bad omen for these politicians and the leaders of these parties if they don't change tact.
Speaking of changing tack, Benny Gantz, a member of the Israeli cabinet, war cabinet, is here to meet David Cameron, probably the prime minister. And all we've heard from David Cameron saying that Israel is an occupying power, that it has a duty under international law to provide aid, that the situation is dreadful, meaning in the Gaza Strip, and people were starving to death. That's all we're getting from the Foreign Secretary of the UK. No canceling of arms license or anything like that to the Israeli regime. What do you make of that?
I think it's very representative of what the British government, what their policy has been so far. I think it's very reminiscent of a, you know, tactic in US and Israeli media of shoot and cry, or that's how the saying goes, of you participate and actively encourage the death of people, you know, and simultaneously shed tears for those that you've murdered. Israelis will do it when they pretend like the thousands of dead children are simply, you know, that they when they pretend that they mourn for those children when they clearly don't. And
just we saw the Americans airdrop aid into the Gaza Strip.
And we have, you know, Americans and British politicians time and time again saying that enough, you know, too many people have died, but will simultaneously provide weapons to encourage the killing of more people.
Absolutely. Let me put one final question to Rick. And Rick, the Biden administration, it is argued, is bargaining above anything else for a grand bargain, rather, that would include Palestinian statehood, security guarantees, and recognition of Israel by Saudi Arabia. As Palestinian statehood, of course, firmly opposed by the current Prime Minister Netanyahu. Is any of that achievable?
Well, we can just look at history, because they've been, you know, talking about one version or another of the two-state solution for, you know, for 50 years. And where are we? You know, beyond the need for a ceasefire, which, you know, is, of course, the first priority, we've got apartheid in Israel, and we've got the occupation. And, you know, there has to be some the issue has to be dealt with sooner than later, because it's gone on, it's festered for all these years, and it's come to this. The United States, you know, has really shown itself. It's not an honest broker. There some other international forces need to play the leading role here.
All right. Thank you for that. That is all the time we have. My thanks to our guest, Tara Rothman, here in the studio with me, and Rick Sterling. Until next time, continue to keep Palestine in your hearts. Goodbye.
Bustle of life. The sound of living. Only sound will endure. IRIB English Radio. in the limelight.
The Ukraine war is giving NATO countries the chance to test their advanced weaponry on an actual battlefield. We take a look at some of the world press and media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The Washington Post has covered this story and tells us more. U.S. military planners are using the Ukraine war as an active and bountiful research opportunity to prepare for a conflict with more sophisticated rivals such as Russia or China. The Washington Post cited a classified year-long study on the lessons learned from both sides of the bloody campaign, saying it will help inform the next national defense strategy, a sweeping document that aligns the Pentagon's myriad priorities. The Washington Post said the study was led by 20 officers who examined five areas: ground maneuver, air power, information warfare, sustaining and growing forces, and long-range fire capability. A senior unnamed military official told the Washington Post, "We immersed them in this conflict to make sure that they were understanding the implications for warfare." Another official said, "The lessons taken from Ukraine stand to be an enduring resource. Ukraine has demonstrated that everything U.S. troops do in the field, from planning missions and patrolling to the technology that enables virtually every military task, needs to be rethought." Washington and its NATO partners have viewed Ukraine as a proxy war to weaken Russia. While the Biden administration has touted this policy, as for Ukraine, it has severely harmed the country. In the early months of the war, Kiev nearly reached an agreement with Moscow to end the conflict, and Russian forces would withdraw to the pre-invasion lines. However, Washington and London pressured the Ukrainian leadership to abandon that diplomatic path. Since then, Russia has achieved victories and is advancing in key areas along the battlefront. Ukraine is struggling to arm its forces and has suffered 500,000 casualties. Recently, the war has escalated to attacks on cities, while Ukraine has suffered substantial infrastructure damage. Last week, Russia achieved its first major territorial success in more than 9 months in the war, capturing the eastern Ukrainian city of Avdiivka. A soldier who escaped the city told the Associated Press that the Ukrainians were outnumbered 5-1. One Ukrainian told the Associated Press news agency of Kiev's increasingly aggressive conscription policy. He lamented, "It's a feeling that everyone wants to throw you into a meat grinder." Recently, the Ukrainian president, Volodymyr Zelensky, described the situation on the battlefront as extremely difficult due to delayed Western supplies of military aid. Meanwhile, more than 6 million Ukrainians who took refuge in Europe, the United States and Canada after the war broke out in February of 2022 worry whether they will ever be allowed to settle in the long term. With no end to the war in sight, governments that offered them short-term help now face a much bigger bill than they expected and are looking to control the spending. But Western arms manufacturers are reaping exorbitant profits from the prolongation of the Ukraine war. American weaponry sales overseas rose sharply last year, reaching a record total of $238 billion. The State Department reported the U.S. government directly negotiated $81 billion in sales, a 56% increase compared to 2022. The rest were direct sales by the U.S. military companies to foreign nations. Ukraine's neighbor Poland, currently on a drive to expand its military, made some of the biggest purchases, to a tune of $30 billion, from the United States. On Wednesday, British arms maker British Aerospace Systems reported record profit of £25.3 billion in 2023 amid the ongoing wars in Ukraine and Gaza. British newspaper The Financial Times has also covered the same story and tells us more. Ukraine's war with Russia is giving NATO countries the chance to test their advanced weaponry on an actual battlefield, and they're gaining valuable insight as a result. NATO members, including the United States, Canada, Britain, Germany and France, have been giving Ukraine weapons and training since Russia launched its special operation in February of 2022. And the kinds of weaponry they have handed over have become increasingly advanced since the war began, with Ukraine pushing for modern tanks, air defense systems and aircraft. The Ukrainian defense minister told the Financial Times that because of this, Ukraine's allies can actually see if their weapons work on a battlefield, how efficient they work and if they need to be upgraded. The Ukrainian defense minister said, "For the military industry of the world, you can't invent a better testing ground." Petro Pyatakov, a retired colonel who is now a consultant for the arms industry, told the Financial Times that there was an active interest from Western artillery manufacturers in receiving feedback from Ukrainian gunners to supposedly eliminate shortcomings. He said that the fighting in Ukraine has exposed some issues. "It has become apparent during operations that these systems were not intended for such intense warfare." A German defense contractor also told the outlet that they had learnt really a lot from the soldiers in Ukraine, who once they noticed something, suggested and our software engineers sit down so that they can have an update. Meanwhile, Jack Watling, from the London-based think tank, the Royal United Services Institute, told the Financial Times that the fighting in Ukraine had also given the West new information about how Russian weaponry worked. But he warned that the West has exposed a lot of its own capabilities to Russia and China, and therefore will have to change the ways that some of its equipment work in order to retain competitive advantage.
Questions and answers in Islamic upbringing.
I have a son. He's really fond of football, and he's so weak in his lesson courses. I really don't know what should I do.
Could you tell me when we have to start upbringing of our kids, that is, from the very beginning of the birth?
I have a little son, and he's so disrespectful. I want to know how to treat him according to the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them.
Answering parents' questions in upbringing their children in an Islamic way.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Welcome to IRIB English Radio, where we will be exploring the Islamic upbringing of children and youth, guided by the wisdom of the Quran and the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt. Today we are honored to have Sister Salma Khalfan, a distinguished Islamic researcher, with us to shed some light on this important subject. Salamu alaikum, Sister Salma, and thank you so much for joining us today.
Alaikum salam wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Thank you so much for having me over.
So we've been discussing this question for a few episodes, and you know, about how to guide the teenage son, especially before they grow up and before it's too late.
Yeah.
And you gave some very nice important points where, you know, you mentioned about trustworthiness, truthfulness, grateful to parents, like how to inculcate all of these characteristics in the child. And the last point we have been discussing was, you know, how to instill not getting attracted to this world and the worldly things in easily. And
material
that at times,
stuff.
Yeah, this material stuff, which at times is very difficult. So you've been mentioning that. Do you have anything more to say about that, or should we go to the next point?
Yeah, we go to the next point now. The next point is wasting time and money. It's important to inculcate that to a young child when he grows up about maybe 12, 11, 12,
yeah.
When you start giving him some pocket money to choose, maybe buying his stuff or maybe for school or something like that. You have to really gently explain him that this money doesn't come by easy and we don't have to waste it or, you know, just lose it. Sometimes this child is so careless that he just puts aside his money and loses it, or it's being stolen or stepped, things like that. Or not to waste it. For example, waste in buying things that are unnecessary, or keep on buying things that, you know, or, okay, use to what you require
need.
And need.
Yeah.
And also you at the same time, don't go to places where your daughter or son feels that you're shopping every day.
Yeah.
You know, some mothers have this habit that they want to shop the best clothes and they keep on shopping, and then the child asks, but you have this at home. The child is innocent. They'll ask them, you have this, you have two of these at home.
Yeah.
Why do you want to buy? And the mother says, no, just for my own fancy. For example, I like the style of it. So the child will also learn. Yeah, when you like a style of it, you keep on buying. But that's nothing other than israf.
Yeah, and I think it's sometimes there's this fine line between wasting and kind of thinking that this is not important. So, for example, I remember there was a time when I was young, when I used to, like, my flash disks, I was given flash disks and it got lost. And this, you know, my mom was like, it's not good, you know. And I was like, no, this is worldly things, you know, you don't have to care about these things. And then she was like, no, that's
yeah,
israf,
exactly. Yeah, not laying importance on the things that you buy and then when it's lost, right?
Yeah,
that even is israf. In effect, that you have to buy again.
Yeah,
in the long run, you need
exactly.
it, right? So it's like if, for example, you iron roughly your clothes and they get burnt, it's just a worldly thing. No, that doesn't mean that. You know, you take care of it. Or you wear your shoes. In fact, our Ahlul Bayt used to have the clothes, special attire for outside and for the home wear.
Yeah.
So outside, you know, your clothes are preserved so that you don't keep on buying other clothes. And home wear is like, you know, they get worn out and everything. So it doesn't mean that, you know, you keep on, you know, like you're underestimating the fact that this dunya is nothing, and okay,
everything is okay.
No, that's wasting actually. So Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala also says, "Kulu washrabu wa la tusrifu." So eat and drink, but do not do israf. And sometimes israf can be done in also overeating, for example, as far as eating is concerned.
Yeah,
you know, overdoing something. So israf is not just that you for example, not do it, or it can be done.
Sometimes excessive doing it.
And or not doing it at all is also israf. For example, sometimes we have some food that is left over and we feel that if we don't eat it, it will be israf. No, our stomachs will pain in the end. So that is more israf. So we have to decipher.
Yeah, very true. So we're just going to take a quick break and pick up shortly from this.
This is Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
Contact us at englishradio@irib.ir.
So welcome back to IRIB English Radio, where we have been discussing a very important aspect to inculcate in our children, which is how to handle money. And you've been mentioning about, you know, we don't have to waste it or uselessly spend it. And, you know, money is actually something that we have to be careful about, and just generally to instill that in our children.
Yeah.
So, yeah. Do you have anything more to say about
it? Yeah, the last but not least is one master character trait and virtue that by observing all these things that I talked about in the previous programs and even today some of them, is that that piety will be achieved.
Mm.
That piety that we are working for without spelling it to be a taqwa, a piety, telling them, be pious, be pious. All these qualities will instill a piety in him, a fear of him, that what he's doing, he should be aware, he should be truthful, he should be trustworthy, he should not, he should be grateful to his parents, that Allah has given him such good parents, or parents at least.
Yeah.
He should be grateful for that, and he should be also not wasting his time, money, energy, be focused, be determined. All these things, if you go and see, gives a perfect plan for a teenager to tread on that path, that of perfection that Allah wants for him, and that his growth lies in it, and he will become successful in both worlds. So without telling, come, I teach you about piety. You know what piety is?
Yeah.
No. Teach about all these things, truthfulness, trustworthiness, like respecting parents, respecting elders. All these things come under being grateful, of course, to parents, because parents would like their children to respect elders also.
Definitely.
Being determined, having a goal, a purpose, not wasting time, money. All this together bring about the taqwa. So we as elders also, if we want the taqwa, we should practice all this, and more so teenagers, because teenagers have that aptitude of picking up very fast, being influenced.
Yeah.
So if we they will think about it. They won't, you can fool a child easily, but you can't fool a teenager or an adult. They will see your actions, that if they're doing that and their contrary is speaking something else. So we should be very careful, especially near teenagers. If you want to start right away, we can do that without, beforehand. Like this parent, mashallah, she's very determined to do a great job on her teenager. I pray for that to happen.
Inshallah.
So she's been like wanting to know beforehand.
Yeah, and I think when you see such a teenager, who has all these qualities, you kind of have a certain sort of
love and attraction, right?
Yeah, because it's something very hard to come by, and it's something very hard. They have to have a lot of, willpower to be able to do all of this. So it's definitely.
And our scholars were like that. Imagine those tender teenagers were like that.
Yeah.
Like a great scholar of Ayatollah Misbah Yazdi. He was just 17 when he came, and how he was as a teenager, you feel, mashallah. What upbringing he must have had, that he had all those quality.
Right.
And that's why when he passed away, like he was so, mashallah, with so many good, he left behind so many good teachings and books and
definitely
all his works.
And I think just recently we were talking to some of the, we were seeing actually a video, and they were saying, why do we have all these shuhada martyrs, streets names, and why is it so important to constantly remind yourself that, okay, this is the, they know that they live in the street and they don't know much about that shaheed, but just this reminder that you have these kind of youth who are able to be such pure people,
accomplish such things,
and it was hard, but they managed, so we can
exactly. And they were not masoom, so if they were not and they could, so why not us?
Definitely.
Any teenager, if he sees and is given this kind of atmosphere, will reach great heights.
Definitely.
I that believe that strongly,
inshallah. So we're just going to take another short break and we'll be back soon.
Ya muqdi al khayrat, Ya muqdi al khayrat.
The Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa alihi wa sallam said, a righteous child is indeed a flower from the flowers of paradise.
Ya muqdi al khayrat, Ya muqdi al khayrat.
Welcome back, and we're going to pose another question where somebody has asked, my 15-year-old daughter doesn't talk about any of her problems with me, and I can know she's going through some tough times, but she feels I'm nagging when I ask her how she's facing all these problems. How do I make her confide in me?
When teenagers, come of that age, they suddenly become aloof.
Yeah.
Because they want their independence. It's not a wrong thing. We should allow that also. But this parent seems like she must be nagging. if that girl feels like she's nagging, okay. Her daughter feels like she's nagging. Because children know when the parents are not nagging or they're nagging, right? When you keep on asking, keep on stressing, then the child will not feel like, in fact, they'll be more stubborn not to say that, yeah?
Mm.
So what the teenagers, especially girls, they're soft-hearted, they need support, love, empathy, all these things are very important. So if the parent gives that quiet moment and then quickly steals the moment when the child is talking,
yeah,
you know, finds a good moment and becomes an active listener. This is very important. Active listening. Active listening is when you're, for example, doing even something and the child wants to talk a little to you, immediately go to the child and listen to them, especially when it comes to teenagers and especially when it comes to this girl who's 15-year-old and doesn't want to talk about anything. At some point in time, the parents will try to make them happier. Maybe cook their best meal or make them laugh or, you know, become lighthearted. Even the mood of the home, you know, the atmosphere should be so lighthearted so that it penetrates in the mind and heart. And not anxiety-filled that you're worried, she's worried. Okay, there's a kind of ice in between. Calm behavior. Okay, this happens. This is normal. Then slowly, slowly they let out. As soon as they start talking, grasp the moment. Whatever you're doing, if they need you, grasp the moment. Not that, okay, now I'm doing, hold on, let me finish this ironing of mine or cooking of mine, then I'm coming to sit with you. No. Leave that aside, however urgent it might be, which is not that much urgent, I believe. Mm-hmm. Any home task cannot be that urgent. It can wait a little. And go and talk and confide so that the girl can confide. And when she sees that there's a reassurance, there's a love, there's a empathy, obviously she will even talk about it.
Yeah.
Whatever be it, even it'll be little, she won't let out. Don't expect that they let out each and every detail of what they're going through. But they will at least say what's going on. Maybe she lost her friend. Maybe she fought with her friend. Or maybe she was scolded by her teacher or given warnings or harmed by somebody or hit by somebody. She will talk about it then. Yeah? What's bothering her? Teenagers, they have this kind of problems.
And I feel like many times the teenagers feel that, the parents don't take their problem seriously, you know, like, for example, this is important to me, but if my mother just takes it lightly, or, you know, then I feel like she doesn't understand me, you know,
exactly.
Like, she doesn't get me.
But my friend understands
me. But yeah, for example, others understand me. So this kind of relationship, I feel like I had a very nice relationship with my mom. She would, you know, try and understand me. She would try and be an active listener. And I felt like that is the main reason why I never fell astray, because she was constantly like there, was backing me up, you know, was giving me that support, which I felt like I was...
There's somebody to understand me and love
me. She understands me.
And don't complain.
Definitely.
Right?
So I think that is very important. So we're going to end here, and inshallah, maybe we can expand on this in the next episode. Thank you so much for your valuable time, and we hope to see you in the next episode. Thank you, dear listeners, for listening. And this was IRIB English Radio, where we had a discussion on child upbringing. If you want to listen to our programs or get more information, you can log on to parstoday.ir/en under the tab COI, which is Call of Islam. And if you type in Call of Islam Radio, you can find it on YouTube and Instagram. And you can also email us on englishradio@irib.ir. God bless you all.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave 31 meters, 9650 kilohertz for the Indian subcontinent, and FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on IranSat or BAD 5 and IntelSat 39 and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
Of the soil, from the blood and the ashes, it speaks with me the sound of the rain, from the battle and the victory.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.